A family in limbo today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Eloise Stevens is a DACA recipient from Liberia whose legal status could end soon. And her mom, she's just been told her status expires next year.
Even though we're on different statuses, we're under different labels, we're still, at the end of the day, dealing with the same situation.
Also, a radio station in South Africa assigns a reporter to focus exclusively on Cape Town's water crisis, and listeners approve.
Because we are told not to believe everything on Facebook, I would rather want to hear it from a reputable person who is on my radio, who I trust.
Plus, recalling a childhood spent chasing fireflies in Pakistan.
Watching them flying around in pitch darkness, it still fills me with joy.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's good to have you here this Thursday. DACA, TPS, U, and T visas, a whole bunch of different letters there, and the source of serious stress for citizens of several countries who are worried that certain U.S. government protections for them are about to end. We've dealt with this a lot since President Trump came to office, vowing to do just that, end temporary protections for a variety of immigrants. Here's an example you probably haven't heard that much about, though. Deferred Enforced Departure, or DED. This one has offered temporary protections for some Liberians. Thousands came to the U.S. after fleeing their country's back-to-back civil wars and then the Ebola outbreak. This week, the Trump administration said it would allow the program to run just one more year. That would leave the nearly 4,000 Liberian recipients of DED in limbo come April 2019. Among them, Louise Stevens. She was the focus of one story in our recent series, Walls We Don't See. And today we're speaking with her daughter, Eloise Stevens, who's also facing uncertainty of her own as a DACA recipient. Eloise, hello. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, we should note that we were hoping to have both you and your mom on to talk with us, but she works two full-time jobs. Is that right?
She has a full-time job and a part-time job. She has no choice to work that many hours in a day. She has a house, and I'm on DACA, so she pays for my school. So she's a very, very busy person working all the time.
When did your mom come to the U.S., and what has she told you about her decision to leave Liberia?
We both actually came together. We came here in the year 2000. Like many Liberians, the war put you in an impossible place. It was kind of stay and not know what your future will hold and go and have some hope for the future. So it was kind of a decision that was pushed on you for many Liberians.
How old were you at the time?
I was 2 years old.
Right. So you don't probably remember too much about the Civil War.
None at all.
So as you said, you're a recipient of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Does that mean you're also facing some uncertainty?
Yeah. So with the whole DACA situation that's going on, DACA doesn't have a pathway to citizenship, and the program continuation isn't clear for the future. So even though we're on different statuses, we're under different labels, we're still, at the end of the day, dealing with the same situation.
Right. So your mother has DED, but you have DACA. How did that work out?
When I came here, I was filed under asylum of my father, and he got deported. So then I lost my status through that. And because I was so young, it was hard for me to get DED. So the only option I really had was DACA.
Right. So kind of complex bureaucratic rules sent you in that direction.
Yeah.
Can I ask you why your father was deported, and what year was that?
It was around when I was like 11, and he got into like criminal situations, so he got deported.
Now, as I said, DED was set to expire at the end of this month, March 31st, but the Trump administration said it would let it run for one more year before ending it. What kind of relief was that for you or your mother? I mean, did you expect the program would continue?
I didn't know what will happen, to be honest. On one hand, it's a relief to know what your future is. With the DED, as long as it's been around, there's always the uncertainty of will it get renewed the next year. And there was never any time to prepare. So for right now, we're kind of just happy that it got extended and kind of living in that moment. But we obviously still have to keep in the back of our minds that it's still not over. It's still not the end we wanted, the end result.
Liberia, as you know, has just had a successful democratic handover of power the first time. There's no civil war. The country has been Ebola-free for almost 2 years. What would you say to people who argue that protections for Liberians can't really be justified anymore.
I would say that Liberia is heading in the right direction, but it's not there yet. We still have, Liberia still haven't reached the place where it can support all these people coming in. And I would also say that these people have lived here for a long time. They've paid taxes, they paid into Social Security, and these are benefits that they are not able to get because of their status. So I would argue that these people have, you know, have earned their place here, have been law-abiding citizens for 20-odd years.
5 years from now, Eloise, where do you ideally see yourself?
Ideally, I hope to have a status where I am able to travel, first of all, because being on DACA or DED, you're kind of, your travel options are limited. So I hope to be able to travel, because coming here when I was 2 years old, I don't remember anything. Everything that I've learned about Liberia has been online or through stories that people have told. So I hope to visit there for myself, but also be here because America has played a huge role in my growing up. I mean, I've been here for most of my life, and even though I don't consider myself an American, I don't deny the impact that America has had on me. Hope to be done with school, you know, going on into a career job. So those are my hopes.
Well, Eloise, thanks very much for telling us your story.
Thank you so much.
Eloise Stevens there, a DACA recipient. Her mother, Louise Stevens, has DED. That's Deferred Enforced Departure. Her protective status is set to expire next year. You can read more about their story over at PRI.org. Immigration is a big talking point in France, too. And one pressing concern is how to accommodate the rising numbers of young people who migrate to France on their own. Last year alone, the French government registered nearly 15,000 unaccompanied foreign minors. And those are just the official numbers. Many of them make their way to Paris, where they wait to hear about their asylum claims. And many of them end up sleeping on the streets. As Adeline Sear reports, a network of volunteers has sprung up to try to feed and house them.
It's lunchtime in this public park in northern Paris. Twice a week, volunteers place large bowls of hot food on picnic tables here. Today's menu, rice and lentils, pastries and bananas. Over 100 young people are here to eat, meet friends and play ping pong, even in the cold and snow. Almost all of them are teenagers between the ages of 15 and 19. They've come from Afghanistan and from a long list of African countries. Once they get to France, it can take authorities up to 14 months to assess whether they are eligible for asylum as minors. In the meantime, many of them end up sleeping on the streets, even though the law says they should be housed immediately.
My name is Faisal Mokhtar. I'm the Sudan. I'm Africa of the Sudan.
How old are you?
17 years old.
Faisal Mokhtar arrived from his native Sudan last May. Like many of these kids, he's homeless. Fortunately, there is help around. Agathe Nadimi is a business school teacher who organizes many relief efforts for these young people. She's a powerhouse advocate in the city. Today, she's handing out cell phones and SIM cards to the homeless teenagers. Nadimi estimates the number of young people living on the streets to be about 300. But she says it's hard to count them because most try to stay invisible. Some sleep on construction sites, others in parking lots, train stations, metro stations, she says. So all I know about is the kids who show up at predetermined meeting spots for minors or those I'm told about by other volunteers. In the coldest weeks of winter, the city opened some gymnasiums for the homeless. But Nadimi says young people don't feel comfortable sharing a crowded space for the night with random adults, some of them troubled.
Je mets à l'abri autant de jeunes que possible grâce à énormément de citoyens solidaires qui se manifestent là avec les températures.
Nadimi says during the last cold spell, she found spaces for up to 90 kids every night, spread over a network of volunteers and NGOs in Paris and hotel rooms Doctors Without Borders is paying for. Last month, when sub-zero temperatures froze Paris, Minister of Interior Gérard Collomb denied the presence of minors on the street. In his videotaped interview, when Collomb was pressed by an activist who said he'd seen dozens of kids on the streets with his own eyes, he replied, "Well, there are a number of minors who refuse to be housed." As the activist nodded in disbelief, Collomb added with a smile, "I follow this question daily." Nadimi is outraged by the suggestion that youth freezing on the street would turn down a home for the night. He's talking nonsense, she says. I'm appalled by how little these politicians know about what's happening in the field. I invite them to spend just one day with me and those kids so they can see who they are and that we rely heavily on volunteers to feed them and keep them warm when it's snowing outside. Nadimi helps organize a network of Parisians which can house about 80 teenagers on any given night. Delphine Dufriche is one of those Parisians.
Je pense que j'ai hébergé une trentaine de jeunes.
Dufriche says in the year and a half since she started housing migrant youth, 30 different kids have crashed on her couch for at least a couple of nights in a row. When I ask her if it doesn't feel weird to have complete strangers share her apartment, she laughs. Yes, it's crazy to live like this, but it's not as complicated as it seems, she says. I'm 46 years old, the age these kids' mothers would be, so I think that makes this kind of relationship simpler, because they have respect for someone their parents' age. Manuela, who prefers not to give her last name, has also offered a couch to these teenagers once in a while. She says she was haunted by the images of wrecked migrants' boats in the Mediterranean and kids on the street. She felt she had to do something. Last year, she housed about a dozen boys. But in recent months, she's mostly been taking care of just two teenagers. She's committed to helping them sort out their new lives in Paris. I fought to get them into school, so that's a lot to undertake, she says. There's paperwork, vaccines, doctor's appointments, everything. It's time, money, and sustained support. For the teenager over 18, it's trying to find legal solutions and opportunities for him. Many of these youth come from former French colonies in Africa, like Cameroon, Chad, and Guinea. Nadimi says they think that heritage will give them a better chance to be accepted and obtain asylum. But in the end, she says, no one cares where they're from. As the mother of a 15-year-old boy herself, she says she's heartbroken to see those teenagers ignored by the system. It's upsetting because I would not let my son sleep even one night on the streets of Paris, she says. Many of the kids Agathe Nadimi has helped call her Maman Agathe or Mommy Agathe. And she says she puts things in perspective for them. I tell them, you know, we don't know what tomorrow will bring, she says. If my country was at war, or if my own son had to travel far from me to the other end of the world, I'd be relieved to know that there are at least a few people around to help him out. I try to do for others what I'd like others to do for me. For the World, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
Coming up later in the show, New Yorkers head to Havana to make a record. Some of them weren't even certain it would work.
It wasn't something I could even conceive of happening. And the idea of like recording a 16-piece big band in a place where like they're rolling blackouts, it just seemed like a pretty grand scheme for someone to try to accomplish. Like, everything kind of had to go right.
Stick around to hear just how right it all went. That's later on the show. And just ahead, a handy guide to trademarking a Viking chant here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. It is a good thing when we have a good news update to a bad news story, and this is good news for South Sudan. It'd be good news for any country suffering from a dreaded parasite known as Guinea worm. South Sudan has actually halted the transmission of guinea worm. Years ago, I saw children in Mali suffering from it. All it took was for them to drink water infected with guinea worm larvae. The worms hatch inside the body and then burrow out through extremities, hands, feet, wherever. It is a painful and dehumanizing disease.
It is. It is very painful for the victims. It is an agony.
That's Makoi Samuel Yibi. He's the National Program Director for Guinea Worm Eradication in South Sudan. What's amazing is that South Sudan managed to get to zero cases, even as it struggles with poverty and civil conflict. Makoi says they were able to do it in part because it is a community-based project.
And we have maintained consistent presence in those communities, even when there was conflict.
South Sudan's government partnered with the Carter Center and other NGOs to battle the disease. The method was simple, supplying water filters to prevent transmission. Former President Jimmy Carter helped lead the campaign, and he says defeating guinea worm would rank high on his list of life's accomplishments. Here he is in 2010 speaking in what was then the southern part of Sudan.
As you may know, when we first began our project in southern Sudan, there were more than 100,000 cases that we found. And I'm sure there were many others that we could not discern at that time. Last year, we had about 2,500 cases, and we believe that in the next two or three years, we'll have zero cases of guinea worm in Sudan.
It took a little longer, but as of last year, there were no confirmed cases in South Sudan. But Makoi Samuel Yibi says even with this success, they have to be vigilant.
And every rumor everywhere would have to be investigated.
Last year, South Sudan had reports of 25,000 suspected cases of guinea worm. All of them turned out to be false alarms. Ethiopia and Chad are now the only two countries in the world where cases of guinea worm were confirmed last year. That's a crowd of Iceland soccer fans cheering on their national team. Two beats and a clap. On the clap, everyone yells, "Huh!" It turns out that the "huh," a word or a grunt, I don't know what it is, but believe it or not, it is trademarked. Someone, an Icelander in fact, actually owns the copyright to it. Another Icelander, cartoonist and comedian, Hugleikur Dagsson, found that out when he started selling t-shirts with the word "huh" on them. So, Hugleikur, is it a word or is it a grunt, and how do you pronounce it?
It's a grunt, really. It's a sound effect. During the football games, what we do is say "huh." So that's the sound. That's what's called the sound that accompanies the Viking clap.
It's a Viking sound? And how do we know it comes from the Vikings?
We do not know. Because the irony of it all is that us Icelanders weren't even the first ones to use this clapping style or the grunt, as you call it, during football games. This originated in Scotland, in fact, our neighbor Viking nation. So if anyone was going to like sue anyone for stealing anything, then it's the Scots who should be suing us.
And speaking of sounds, how do you pronounce your name, Hugleikur?
There is a trick to it, kind of. It sounds a bit like the lyrics to the song "Who Let the Dogs Out."
Okay, so if I say Hugleikur Dagsson?
That's the mnemonic device for
you
people.
You wired it.
Yeah.
Hugleikur, how did you find out that the word or the grunt "huh" or "hu" was a registered trademark?
This is a story. In 2016, we were doing very well in a European football thingy. Here's how much I know about football or soccer.
It's a European football thingy, right. Iceland did really well.
Yeah, we did really well, and it kind of was a good thing for the whole nation because, yeah, we've been kind of divided politically for a few years now and been kind of worried.
You had that economic crisis thing back in 2008, yeah.
Everyone was playing the blame game at each other until we had a really good streak in sport. And then everyone got together. Everyone became friends for one summer, and it was beautiful. And for some reason, this became our, like, slogan for right. Our unity was "who," the sound. So I decided to shamelessly get some likes on my social media sites. So I drew a picture of a stick figure who's saying "who." And it got a lot of likes. And my marketing lady, Raquel, she said, "We will put this on t-shirts and we will make money." And I said, "Yes, please." So we did that. And then a year and a half later, we were told by that someone who owns the word that he owns the word and we cannot print it on T-shirts because, well, he owns the word when it comes to printing on clothes and on alcohol labels.
Right. And this is what I read. The Icelandic Patent Office confirms that Hu was, in fact, trademarked that same year that Iceland was making its big soccer run in 2016 by this man named Gunnar Andresson. Have you spoken to him?
No, I have never spoken to him, and I didn't even know his name until a couple of days ago.
Is Mr. Andresson insisting that you cease and desist?
What he said was that we should either stop printing these T-shirts or give him a part of the profit. He did not specify how much of a part of the profit, but we thought it was kind of lame to reserve that word for yourself, especially in the context that we thought this was something that everyone owned. This is the one thing that we can agree on, is we like it when our footballers score goals.
Yeah. Whose side is the Icelandic public on in this debate?
Within my Facebook bubble, they seem to be mainly on my side. I haven't seen anyone who is on his side, and I'm starting to feel kind of bad about throwing him under the bus. But the fact is that after a few email responses, it was clear that he wasn't going to budge. And I wasn't sure if people would agree with me. So basically, I put this out there, a Facebook status, and I told our story, hey, we can't sell those T-shirts anymore, so we're gonna try to get rid of all of them before he actually shuts us down. It was a slow news day, and Iceland got very excited about it, and everyone was talking about it.
Are you still selling T-shirts?
I think they might be sold out at the moment. But according to a statement that this guy sent out yesterday or the day before yesterday, he's not going to do anything more because he kind of admitted that he has lost the fight, although he felt that the fight was unfair, which it kind of was because he didn't have any voice. And I'm like a B-list celebrity over here in Iceland.
Right.
So
you're talking with the United people... States and the world.
So it's a
Hugleikur, the one thing that I don't know is what Hu means. I mean, is there a meaning?
No, it's just like a war cry, maybe.
Hugleikur Dagsson, I will always remember your name. Who Let the Dogs Out is an Icelandic comedian and cartoonist. He's joined us from Reykjavik. Thanks so much, Hugleikur.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. A New York producer goes to Cuba to record a Mambo album, and when he gets all the musicians together, he is blown away.
The real magic is having a 16-piece band playing in a room together, and each section would sort of sing their parts to each other as they were rehearsing to figure out, like, the intention of every note.
You'll love the results. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The water taps in Cape Town, South Africa, will not hit that existential wall called Day Zero. They will not be going dry, at least not in the next few months. That is the latest news on the city's water crisis. We've been following that story pretty closely here at The World, but another radio outfit has been following it a lot more closely than us. That'd be Smile 90.4 FM. It's a Cape Town station that's made covering the city's drought-driven water crisis its mission for the past year. From our Livable Planet desk, reporter Daniela Cheslow recently paid the station a visit.
Remix of Miriam Makeba's classic Pata Pata kicks off the morning for listeners to Smile 90.4 FM. The station's mix of music and news in English and Afrikaans reaches about 170,000 listeners a day in this city of 4 million people. And lately, it's become a leading source of information about Cape Town's water crisis.
Smile Water Report.
And with your latest update, here's Smile 90.4 FM's water reporter, Saya Pierce-Jones.
Let me be completely honest with you. These days, when it comes to getting clean, I've started taking 10-minute long showers, but I'm only using 5 litres of water each time. How, you may ask?
That's Saya Pierce-Jones, who early last year became the station's full-time water reporter. She used to be a general assignment journalist, but in January 2017, Pierce-Jones got an unsettling piece of news.
I was in the newsroom and I got an email from the city telling us about the consumption levels, the dam levels, and when I worked out some of the numbers, it was really, really scary.
Scary because the city's main reservoir, they call them dams here, was around 40% full. There was no rain in sight, and Pierce Jones felt a lack of urgency around a looming crisis.
No one was keeping track of what is our daily water usage, what are our dam levels. Now suddenly the bigger picture, and that we were sitting in January, we weren't going to get any rain up until our winter rainfall season, and this, what was left in the dams at this rate of consumption, was going to have to last us, and didn't look like it would.
The city was running out of water. Pierce Jones saw a big story, and her boss, program manager Clive Ridgway, saw an opportunity.
There wasn't enough information in Cape Town at the time, and we also felt that we wanted to differentiate ourselves in terms of actually being the first radio station to give the necessary attention to the water crisis.
When the Tierwaters Kloof Dam was originally built, the department's engineers say it was essentially designed to fail at 10% full.
Pierce Jones began filing 8 water reports a day. She went to government meetings. She visited the dams. She met students keeping their rugby fields alive with recycled laundry water. And she gave tips for saving water, like that 10-minute, 5-liter shower.
How, you may ask? Well, that's because instead of actually using the shower, I now use a 5-liter garden pressure sprayer. Basically, I boil some water, fill this little inexpensive device, pump up the pressure, and let it spray. A big thank you to our Smile Water Warriors for sharing this idea. And if you have any other great tips on ways
Pierce
to
Jones
save,
followed the water beat through another dry winter. When rains didn't come, the city got more assertive about its water message. The mayor warned of a day zero when the taps would run dry. Then came tight water restrictions of 13 gallons a day per person. The growing crisis moved from the fringes to the front of everyone's mind.
If it doesn't rain like they're expecting, we are in big trouble.
On the day we met, I followed Pierce Jones to a conference on how the crisis will affect industry in the city. Dozens of business leaders attended.
And they're struggling at the moment with big conference guys that are on the phone every second day saying, listen, we're probably going to cancel our trip to Cape Town because we're so worried about this crisis. So I think the report for today will be about, you know, the message that's going out there to businesses to say, start thinking about climate change, you know, adapt or die kind of thing.
Smile 90.4 FM's decision to cover the water crisis closely seems to have hit the spot with listeners.
You know, we're becoming so innovative in saving water and they give such great tips.
Estelle Mati is a longtime listener to the station. She says the water saving advice has helped her change her routines, but she also appreciates that the station is doing real reporting on the crisis.
We need to know in depth what's going on at every dam, and we want to know what the government is doing. Because we are told not to believe everything on Facebook, I would rather want to hear it from a reputable person who is on my radio, who I trust.
Recently, the Regional Environment Ministry gave Smile Radio an award for its work, the only one it's given to a media outlet in the water crisis. And in the past few weeks, there's been a note of relief in the station's water news.
7 o'clock, a very good morning to you. My name is Mornay Esben. City officials say there's a small chance of some good rain this coming winter season, but they remain confident that Capetonians will not see a day zero scenario, at least not this year.
The city now says day zero won't happen this year, thanks in part to water-saving residents. This development has changed the mission at Smile 90.4 FM. Ridgway, the program manager, told me he ended the water beat.
In Cape Town right now, the conversation has become far broader, and there's so much more information now that the reports themselves were no longer serving the same purpose.
These days, the anchors do a daily index on where the dam levels are and how much water people use. And Pierce Jones has been reassigned to general news. She says it's a sign of the times.
Yeah, maybe it's we can kind of relax now. We've almost done our job, but we do have to keep reminding people. And this water messaging has to be a permanent thing.
Because while day zero has been put off, the water crisis is still very real. For the world, Daniela Cheslow, Cape Town.
It's Milk and Sugar featuring Mary Makeba, Yama Pata Pata on Smile Breakfast with Bobby.
Love that remix of Mary Makeba, Pata Pata, for some Wata Wata. Cape Town isn't the only place in the world struggling with water supply. Occasionally, though, a solution comes along that's remarkably simple and can make a huge difference. That's what's happening in some small villages at the other end of the African continent. Also from our Livable Planet desk, here's Rebecca Rossman in southern Morocco.
Here's a sound you're no doubt used to, water running from a tap. But running water is a relatively new concept for Ensoda Bokhifa, who lives in a village in the Ait Bamran tribal region of southwest Morocco. It's dry here. The village is only 20 miles from the edge of the Sahara Desert. Bokhifa tells me that for years, she and hundreds of other local women and kids had to walk up to 3.5 hours a day to get water from local wells. And even with all that effort, it wasn't always safe to drink. But now, the 1,200 villagers here finally have running water. This isn't thanks to the rain gods. The region receives only about 5.5 inches of rain a year, barely 10% of the global average. Instead, it comes from here, the top of Mount Boutmizgira. Munir Abar works for a local development agency called Darcy Hamed. He's their fog technician. When there's fog up here, he says, it's magnificent. Today's sunny, but this region has an average of 143 foggy days a year. On a really good day, Abar says, you feel like you're walking in a cloud. And that's where the water comes from. Abar shows me a series of 15 honeycomb-shaped nets suspended from steel poles, rising maybe 10 feet above the rocky brown mountainside. The nets are a special German technology called Cloudfisher that can withstand winds of up to 75 miles an hour and collect thousands of gallons of water a day from the sky. The fog comes in from the sea, Abar says. The wind pushes it towards the nets and droplets condense out and fall into a basin. And then the water goes from the basin into these pipes, and these pipes go into the ground, then they go to a reservoir that I'm looking at right now, where it becomes filtered. Then it goes down again through more pipes and into the villages in the surrounding area. Residents pay a small fee for the water, but they say it's worth it.
How does the water taste?
It's good. Yeah. Oh, it is good.
That's 24-year-old Mohamed Hamu Ali. He says one of the biggest advantages of the new water system is the time it frees up for other things.
I have a lot of free time, yeah.
Ali says he and his family can now use that time to focus on other things like their work producing argan oil, one of the region's most profitable products. Spread out over several remote villages, that can make a big difference.
We believe in the projects that we've done.
That's Jamila Bargash, who runs the Darcy Hamed Development Agency. She says the nets already provide more than 5,000 gallons of water every foggy day. And she says Darcy Hamed is at work on doubling the size of the project and the amount of water it can capture.
That's more than enough for the communities we service, who use an average of 26 liters per day per person, and the extra water we are using for the farm.
That new fruit and vegetable farm will be irrigated mostly with fog water. But Bargash says there have been some challenges in adapting to the new technology.
The common belief is that fog prevents the rain. And so people dislike fog. They don't trust it.
There's even been resistance from some women who took pride in their role as water warriors tasked with providing such an essential resource. To help ease the transition, Darcy Hamed has opened a water school where young girls and boys learn about the fundamentals of water management, irrigation, and sustainability. For her part, Ensoda is happy to have a new water system and the time it frees up for other things. Now my kids think about their studies, she says. They don't have to think about getting water. And that could make the biggest difference of all here. Meanwhile, similar projects are underway in the mountainous regions of Yemen, Chile, Mexico, and South Africa. Fog harvesting could soon even make its way to Northern California to help address that state's ongoing drought. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Ait Bamran, Morocco.
If you remember chasing fireflies when you were a kid, you'll probably relate to this next story. It comes to us from our friends with the BBC's Fifth Floor podcast, specifically from my colleague Kashif Kamar with the BBC's Urdu language service. Growing up in Karachi, Pakistan's largest city, he remembers fireflies were abundant, but not so much anymore. He says fireflies are now a rare sight in the city. Kamar thinks changing weather patterns and increased light pollution are the main culprits. But in any case, he was feeling nostalgic. So he decided to make a radio documentary to recapture what he felt as a kid watching those fireflies.
Pure magic. Watching them flying around in pitch darkness, it was something like flying matches. it was absolute fascination and something which, when I try to figure out in my head now, it still fills me with joy. We would try to catch them, play with them. It was not an easy thing, but with the practice, we mastered it. When you become an expert in following them, you know that something was blinking here. It will blink just 2 feet away. We used a piece of thin cloth. It's called dupatta. It's a very fine net. And we used to cast that net into the air with an idea that fireflies must be on that particular place. If we were really lucky, we might be able to catch 4, 5, 6, 7 at a time. And we used to play with them, using them. Oh, look at that, they are blinking, they are blinking. I used to do it with my friends, especially during the monsoon. Soon after the rain, we can go out, we can search for fireflies. Karachi was not as polluted, as dirty, and as big as it is now. I lived in a place which was very close to a riverbed, and there was some fields, some bushes, and around that vegetation, soon after rains, there will be plenty of fireflies. I have two little daughters, and I keep comparing my own childhood with the childhood of my daughters. I felt that it is a really sad thing that the wonder I felt with fireflies, my daughters won't be able to see that. So I thought, okay, why not? Go ahead with that and make a documentary about it. It was a later thought. Initially, I was thinking that I would simply explain my own experiences and will try to explain the absence of fireflies in today's world. But while making this documentary, I realized that the loss is much more than this scientific fact that fireflies are disappearing. And the change in the world or the natural environment must have been different for my mother. So I asked my mother, and she was even more nostalgic.
It was usually in the monsoon seasons, but after rain, and when we were sleeping in the open, that's when we saw jugnus. Watching their flashes in pitch dark nights, we would forget to sleep.
My mother also told me that I never thought why we couldn't see them anymore.
When I remember those days now, it replays in my mind. It's all a long, long time ago, when I was maybe 13 or 14 years old. 70 years ago. It's now just a glimpse through my memories.
Kashif Kumar's mother there. Kashif works for the BBC's Urdu service, and his documentary is called The Magic of Fireflies. I read the other day that going to a concert can be more beneficial to your longevity than doing yoga. All right, I can't take you to a concert, but I can offer you this instead. I already know it's one of the hottest things I'll hear this year. Imagine the soul of Daptone Records, the home of the late Sharon Jones, mixed with the grit and heart of Cuban mambo. It'd sound something like this. This is Orquesta Akokan. Akokan from the West African Yoruba language, meaning from the heart. The group's DNA is rooted in both New York and Havana. Their debut album was recorded in Cuba with a serious big band of Cuban music veterans, but it's coming out on the Daptone label in Brooklyn. We'll get to why in a few minutes. Three friends from New York put the whole thing together. Jose Pepito Gomez, singer, originally from Cuba, arranger Mike Eckroth, and producer and tres player Jacob Plassey. Plassey has been deep in New York's Latin scene for a few years. It all started with the best kind of initiation to the music.
I saw Eddie Palmieri in Prospect Park, summer of my freshman year. It was like a beautiful, starry night. There were like a couple thousand people dancing, beautiful women. I was in.
Plassey put college on pause. He went to Cuba and learned what this music was at the source. and returning to New York.
I actually learned the, felt like I learned the most when I came back here and just playing gigs around town and bars and stuff. And then that's how I eventually met Pepito.
Empecé cantando con un trío que tocaba música similar al trío Los Panchos en...
Pepito's own story, as he tells it, began his musical career young as a vocalist in the Cuban town of Florida. He then tried his hand at the trumpet and was pretty good, but a local band was suddenly desperate for a new singer, and they offered the gig to Pepito. He had a couple of other big breaks, but the one that became his calling card was when he became the lead vocalist for the legendary Pupi y los que son son.
Y yo pertenecía a la Asociación de Autores.
Pepito explains that when he used to attend meetings of the Cuban Musicians Union, he felt that younger artists were being unfairly sidelined, and that didn't please him, so he began thinking of making music elsewhere. In 2008, Pepito defected to the U.S.
And a Pupi, Los Que Son Son. So I'm number one a fan.
This is New York-based producer and tres player Jacob Plassey again.
And I have a band here, and I knew Pepito, so I'd have Pepito sub, and I, you know, tried to become friendly with him. Eventually we began talking about doing a project together, and we tried to do it in New York, but, like, it just didn't really work.
Plassey says he has enormous respect for Latin musicians in New York, but as he and arranger Mike Eckroth built their catalog of original mambo compositions for the still-nascent Orquesta Acocan project, they were finding the big-city Latin players a little too distracted. They didn't have time to rehearse and polish up the old-school mambo sound that they were aiming for. So they focused their sights on Cuba, and they asked, why not record at the source? They thought a dream studio would be Arayito in Havana. Artists like Arsenio Rodriguez, Celia Cruz, and Benny More recorded there. Even Frank Sinatra recorded tracks at Arayito.
It wasn't something I could even conceive of happening, and Pepito actually suggested it, and I was like, yeah, that's going to happen. And then suddenly we were on flights to Havana, and we had all these charts, and it just sort of came together in a really natural way.
And why were you at first skeptical that you could do this in Havana?
Well, the idea of, like, recording a 16-piece big band in a place where, like, they're rolling blackouts, it just seemed like a pretty grand scheme for someone to try to accomplish. Like, everything kind of had to go right.
And it kind of did. Here's the thing about Arayito Studios, according to Pepito Gomez.
He grabado en todos los estudios que tiene Cuba, pero Arayito tiene algo especial que...
Pepito says the studio is special because of the wood. It is old, built in the 1940s in a colonial house in the center of Havana. The building used to be a processing plant for tobacco. And that wood interior, says Pepito, just gives the music a beautiful sound. Lindísimo, he says.
Tiene un sonido lindísimo, muy lindo.
I don't think it would have happened in New York because I couldn't have afforded a studio like Arayito in New York. I can nerd out about gear and tape and all that stuff, but I think the real magic is having a 16-piece band playing in a room together and moving all that air and interpreting it. And, like, as we would go, what was so cool for me to watch was each section would sort of sing their parts to each other as they were rehearsing to figure out exactly how, like, the intention of every note, which was just, like, mind-blowing to me.
Algo rapidito.
But what about that Brooklyn Daptone connection? Why would this retro soul label from New York welcome a totally different genre of music?
I think more than anything is that, you know, they're a soul label, but they're also, they just really love great music.
And Plassey says soul and mambo, there is a connection. Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, that's your grandparents' soul music. And Orquesta Acocan is your grandparents' mambo.
A lot of these musics were flourishing at a similar time period and were more interconnected than people like to think, but also... there's just, I think the rhythm and the dance aspect translates really well for what they want to do, and recorded in a certain way that's gritty and live.
So, did it all work? Well, the music speaks for itself, but you can also ask the Cuban musicians who played on the session. Pepito has this great story.
Una anécdota bonita, que llegamos y cuando se terminó la grabación, que los músicos que fueron músicos...
After the recording session, Pepito says some of the local veteran Cuban musicians who were brought into the project wanted to know who did the arrangements.
¿Quién hizo esos arreglos tan... ¿Qué hizo esos arreglos? ¿Sabe...?
This was someone who really knows his music, they were saying. That guy over there, someone said, pointing at Jacob's partner, Mike Eckroth.
Ese blanquito chiquitico gordito? No.
That white dude there? No way. Orquesta Acocan's debut CD comes out tomorrow. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Thanks so much for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.